had to say about the decisions made by this group and its legitimacy, and you know, the kind of course that they may set is one that maybe the leaders agree with, but you got to sell it to the people. And will the people take this sort of tough medicine, bitter medicine, for 20 years if it's going to go out that far? So I'm quite interested in that, but also your sense about where the whole process is going. So if you're okay, can I start this?
Yeah, you can. I thought of that.
I'm just to begin, and do you have your own thing
going? Yes, it's
okay.
Yeah.
Professor Gill, just to begin, could I get you, for the purposes of authenticity, to state your name and your title?
Yeah, my name is Stephen Gill. I'm a distinguished research professor of political science, communications and culture at York University in Toronto.
And Stephen, what would be your area of specialization?
It's two main areas, actually. One is international relations, broadly speaking, and particularly geopolitical relations, geopolitical shifts in the balance of relations of power. And the other is global political economy, which encompasses everything from the financial questions which we raised in our telephone discussion, and down to the relationship between taxation and changes in people's everyday lives, the provisioning for people mm-hmm. in their everyday lives.
Okay. Generally, how do you view this thing? I'm just going to get us rolling here. How do you view the prospects for any kind of accomplishments to come out of this G20 meetings that are happening next week?
Well, it depends on how you look at the issue of accomplishments. I mean, in a sense, for a global institution, an institution of global governance, to produce a communique that looks as if it has come to agreements from the vantage points of the participants, then it's a success. The key issue is not necessarily procedural, however, it's what is the actual substance of what they are agreeing upon, and what are the implications of those agreements for policy and in due course the effects on people's lives and prospects for the future. And of course there's a great deal of scope for disagreement about those questions. If you looked at it from the viewpoint of what kinds of problems the G20 is addressing, and you ask what kinds of problems exist and problems for whom, then you would come up with some different approaches to answering the questions.
They are primarily focused, and if we're looking at economic and business issues, primarily focused on stabilizing the global economy, dealing with the sovereign debt issue, which has blown up in Europe, and then the compelling need for reform, global financial services reform. And all of this stuff seems to take place about 30,000 feet over most people's heads. Do you think they will be affected, that the ordinary people will be affected by any of the decisions made at this conference?
Well, it's possible that the effects could be very, very significant and very deep and long-standing. I think you have to step back from the institution and look at what the questions and problems are. If we go back a couple of years, 3 years perhaps, we've seen what is being euphemistically called a global financial meltdown, a very deep financial crisis, which has radically destabilized global capitalism. And of course, the first instinct and reflex of politicians, which represent presumably the interests of maintaining some form of stability in global capitalism, is to seek to restore that. And so there have been massive stabilization measures to reinstate the confidence in the financial markets and the credibility of the financial system, which underpins the vast gamut of economic activities. However, that has been done in ways that have not really tackled many of the core problems that were intimately connected to the financial crisis in the first place. And the second issue is, of course, the bailouts seem to have been one-sidedly on behalf of the big banks and large corporations. It's important to ask, from an economic viewpoint, what are the opportunity costs of the choices that were made? Opportunity costs is a term used by economists to say, how do we evaluate choice A in terms of choices foregone, or choices B or C? Now, in my view, the money that was used, the many trillions of dollars that was used to bail out the financial problems, could have been used in more socially constructive ways to produce a more balanced response to the crisis, and it could have led to significant improvements in healthcare, pension provisions, educational expenditures, a whole range of things that matter most to people in their everyday life. That choice was not made. In fact, the bailouts were one-sidedly on behalf of the big financial interests, and they were shaped primarily, I think, by those interests themselves. If you look at the links, for example, in the Obama administration to Wall Street really was still in control of the bailout problem that it created. So I think that the question that you asked is, well, are the G20 decisions going to have an impact upon the everyday lives of people? Well, the answer is, well, the G20 is now facing, well, who is going to pay the bill for those gigantic bailouts? And the answer seems to be the people. And I can deconstruct what that means quite specifically, because the G20 seems to be following the agenda set by the International Monetary Fund and many of the other leading elements in the US Treasury, in the European Union, which is that there will have to be tax increases, there will have to be austerity, there will have to be adjustment, fiscal adjustment, to pay for these bailouts, and indeed also to create a future fund, an emergency fund for future bailouts, which would indicate a limited degree of confidence in the ability to stabilize the system. The managing director of the IMF made a quite an important speech in Cambridge at the end of April to this effect, and said that there would be 10 to 20 years of austerity needed to effectively to be able to stabilize public finances. And we've seen crises surrounding public finances in Europe recently, in Greece and elsewhere, which I think are illustrative of this, although Greece has very specific problems. So if there is...
Who was that, the man from the IMF that you were talking about?
The managing director of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Okay.
He made a speech at Cambridge University.
I'm sorry, I interrupted your train of thought, please.
I think my train of thought was leading me to the following point, that in the bailout programs, which were differentiated throughout the world, but I think one estimate that I put together with my research assistants indicated that if you combined the bailouts in the United States, the European Union, and Britain, it was approximately amounted to $11 trillion. And of course, not all of it was spent, but a good proportion has been. And that came from public finances, and then indirectly from investors that were prepared to buy government bonds and government paper to pay for this. And of course, those investors need to be given interest on their loans. And what's happening now is that governments are adjusting to these very, very high levels of debt, and they need sources of revenue to be able to pay those debts and to give signals to investors in the financial markets that they are capable of financing debts in the future. And governments have pursued policies where it's been very difficult to tax mobile factors, mobile capital, or very high paid workers, celebrities, for example, sports stars, who get very, very high salaries because they can move to other countries or other locations, whereas your typical worker can't, and particularly a typical public sector worker is at the mercy of his employer, and they're people who would be facing higher tax bills. Not necessarily directly in terms of their income taxes, but because governments throughout the world are using value-added taxes, which are regressive indirect taxes, and they tend to hit people lower down the income ladder much harder than those in the upper level. And although governments will assiduously try to pursue certain types of tax evasion, they need the tax revenue, we still have a system in which it seems to be very difficult to get on top of the ability of big corporations, financial firms, and so on to move their profits and losses throughout the world to avoid paying taxes. So the tax base that's required to finance these programs is being proposed by the IMF and as it seems to be agreed by many of the elements in the G20, will fall on the backs of the people. Whereas the cause of the problems, lie to a large degree on the backs of the global elites and the rulers who are connected to the financialization of capitalism, which has been a big feature of the last 20 or 30 years.
Hmm. So you seem to be saying that we're being set up, I mean, populations are being set up to basically endure the pain for who knows how long into the future, 10 years, 20 years, whereas they're really the people who were behind this trouble are largely going to get off scot-free. But people, you know, would say, well, you know, governments are talking about imposing taxes on banks and they're going to start regulating things and they put a wall again between commercial and investment banking and all of these reforms are coming and they'll have to pay. I mean, we've got Europe yesterday saying that they're going to put the bank tax back on the agenda of this meeting after Canada and some other countries thought they slew that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, there's no gentle way, nice way to sugarcoat this pill. Governments have to bring down their levels of debt. Do you agree with that as a sort of first premise? And secondly, where do they get the money from if they don't go to their populations?
Yeah, no, I think that all that you're saying is true. However, are the reforms that you're talking about sufficient to actually produce some kind of democratization over the forces at issue? And what types of forums and what types of mechanisms are going to be used to actually bring these measures to the accountability of the people? I mean, this has been precisely the problem with global finance and with the G8/G20 concept model of governance from the top. It's had an enormous problem of legitimacy. And furthermore, could I just add that its stated goal in this situation is stabilization, and stabilization would have to be paid for in some way or other.
Mm.
But that would stabilization of a democratic type would involve democratizing the very financial markets and private holders of power that are currently forcing governments into many of these austerity measures. I mean, some governments are willingly choosing these measures, but others are having them forced upon them. So that's the first point that needs to be made. And the second point is, if the goal is stabilization, it's by no means clear that a massive shift towards austerity measures will actually provide stabilization. It might actually plunge the situation in a macroeconomic sense into a deeper hole, which would mean that even higher taxes would be needed. The taxes would be punitive on economic activity, and they would bring down, we'd be in a situation like the 1930s.
Well, in fact, that's exactly where I thought you were going with this. What they did in the 30s was they withdrew stimulus and support too quickly, and which just plunged us. I mean, we hear all these warnings now about a double dip. Harper said this today, so did Governor Carney of the Bank of Canada say this. That they're all so panicked about debt levels that they're going to withdraw stimulus too quickly. The government, the private sector, will not be able to pick up the slack, and therefore, you know, we fall off by design. We fall off the cliff.
Yeah. No. I think that their fear is a real one. But there is a difference between now and the 1930s. There are two main differences from a macroeconomic viewpoint. There are many differences from a social and cultural viewpoint, clearly and politically. But in the 1930s. I think about 30% of all workers were in service industries. Today it's about 70%. And the bulk of workers in service industries are actually in public service. They work for governments in one way or another. Secondly, in the 1930s, there was virtually no unemployment insurance. There was very little worker compensation. There were none of the social elements that have been built into post-war capitalism, which are called, in Keynesian terms, automatic stabilizers.
Yes.
And automatic stabilizers include things like public pensions, as well as private pensions. Now, if you embark upon an austerity program which cuts unemployment benefits, which cuts pension benefits, which cuts the redistributive aspect of social programs, which cuts healthcare provisions, which means that people would have to pay for them themselves, the net macroeconomic effects of these things would not only be unequally felt across society, it would hit the poorest the hardest, and it would particularly hit poor single parents, who tend to be mothers, the hardest. It would also have a depressive macroeconomic effect, because these people tend to spend a large proportion of any income that they receive on consumer goods and everyday expenditure, whereas rich people don't. So if you argue, for example, that tax, even if you were arguing the contrary position, that the last thing that we should be doing is increasing taxes right now, the question is, well, what taxes should be reduced? And is that the best way to produce the macroeconomic effect? Well, places, very, very informed organizations like the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives have shown systematically that targeted government expenditures, particularly socially targeted government expenditures, have the biggest macroeconomic boost, not tax cuts, and particularly not tax cuts for rich people who don't want to spend them. So I think that there is a danger from a macroeconomic viewpoint that the situation will worsen. Canada has been relatively shielded from this, so Canadians may not be thinking about this. The same was true in Finland, the country that I just spent the last year in. Mm-hmm. But it's easy to see how the situation in Europe, which seemed to principally concern the southern European countries such as Spain or Greece, Portugal, and now it looks like Italy is under the scrutiny of the financial markets, begins to have a massive effect upon the euro system as a whole. At least Canada has the flexibility to deal with its own macroeconomic situation by depreciating its exchange rate, for example. Mm. The European Union members that are part of the euro system can't. But you can already see that what's occurring in many countries is a kind of beggar thy neighbor situation, that people are using various mechanisms. Britain, for example, has used competitive depreciation of its currency to try and buffer the macroeconomic effects of the crisis. And the G8, G20 may be giving the impression that they are cooperating, if not fully unified, but there seem to be very big differences between key members of the G20. And of course, the G20 itself is not a unitary and simply internally democratic mechanism, because the biggest and most powerful economies are the ones that have the most weight in the G20. In fact, my research assistant, Julian German, did a study for me, and he found there was a leaked British government study of the G20, which indicated it's actually a three-tier structure. And sadly for Canada, we're in the third tier, the biggest economies being at the top. Mm. So the biggest economies are still the ones that are pushing the agendas, and there seems to be a big division between the Anglo-American capitalism of the US and Britain on the one hand, versus the more state-managed neoliberalism of Germany and France that have a more continental form of regulation. And
in the paper that you were mentioning, does he get into the three-tier system?
There's a little footnote on here about it. You'll see it.
So, I mean, you're saying that it's more than likely that the wrong people are going to bear the burden of fixing the global system. Are you at all impressed that the G20 worked fairly well during the crisis, didn't it? They consulted closely, they coordinated, they rolled out policies and programs in a coherent fashion, and then later came out and took a bow for helping us not fall off the cliff. Do you accept that they did well during the crisis and now maybe just be entering in a phase where there's no crisis to concentrate minds? So
well, I think the question is, what was that crisis about? What was the crisis about, and how did they consult about that crisis? The crisis seemed to consist of a global economic emergency that was precipitated by a self-regulating financial system that was highly leveraged and was making excessive claims to its own prudence and stability. For example, using complex derivatives and complex financial instruments such as insurance swaps that basically built a pyramid of leverage of financial assets. And it was triggered by, the collapse seemed to have been triggered by what was called the subprime crisis in the United States. In other words, it was triggered by the practices of banks and financial services giants, particularly on Wall Street, but they exist in Toronto, they exist in London, in Berlin, and in France, which were practicing a kind of self-regulating market model. The governments have basically said finance is efficient. It follows the efficient markets hypothesis of self-regulation, and they allocate capital rationally, wisely, and prudently. And that proved to be Alan Greenspan's fallacy. It was almost like the script from an Ayn Rand novel about the individualization of the economic world. It proved to be based upon a massive fallacy, and when the crisis broke, it seemed to be consummated in a particular moment when the financial institutions refused to lend to each other. They had no credibility in counterpart banks having sufficient capital and stability to be able to repay overnight loans. That's what precipitated the crisis, as far as I know. So it was almost like a heart attack for capitalism. And the surgery that was applied was almost like a kind of massive blood transfusion of more capital into the system. And the people that administered that were the people that were responsible for the regulatory structures that had been constructed in the first place. And they were principally constructed by an axis between Washington, D.C., and Wall Street in the United States, and counterparts in the rest of the world. And it's important to put into perspective that financial profits have become an ever-increasing proportion of total profits of capitalism over the last 40 years. So the medicine was applied by and on behalf of the very interests that had caused the problem. So yes, the G20 did cooperate effectively, but that was the form that the cooperation took.
And now that they don't have this crisis anymore, or at least it's not, we're not the collapse of the global banking system, for instance, doesn't appear to be imminent. They go back to what high-minded aspirations, and basically they start talking amongst themselves again and don't do anything.
Well, I would take issue with the way you put that, because having been in Europe, I did a study of the situation in Greece, for example. Now, many of the European countries in the euro system, which seemed to be a kind of rock of stability in the global financial structure during the early phase of this crisis, are now under tremendous pressure. The euro system is under tremendous pressure, and in fact, many people have been arguing that the euro system could literally fall apart. Certainly it would develop into a two-tier system, with some countries being forced out, perhaps. But the if you look at the situation in Greece, which has received a lot of attention, you see a number of factors at work. And it's important to note that a lot of the problems in Greece are of the Greek government's own making. It's massaged the books with the help of Goldman Sachs. There's been massive tax evasion in Greece. Greeks that can get their money out of the country or out of the tax system remove it from the tax system. There's a big black economy there, and so on. So there are a lot of internal problems there. But the nevertheless, Greece owes a lot of money to creditors, and most of those creditors appear to be in banks in France and in Germany, to a lesser extent the United States. So the Greek bailouts and the funds that are being put together in the emergency measures that we've recently seen in the European Union, they amount to about a trillion euros, I think, in conjunction with the International Monetary Fund, is yet another bailout for the banks indirectly. It's a bailout, of course, for the sovereign problems of Greek debt, and it's a means of helping to stabilize the situation in Europe, but it's also a means of keeping these banks afloat that own large quantities of government bonds. So I don't think that the stabilization is over, nor is the crisis as you defined it over. I think we're still in the middle of it. And as I said, it still begs the question of who pays for the crisis and in what way.
You seem to say that money that goes to Greek or goes to stabilize the financial system is money down a rat hole, or it's just rewarding irresponsible behavior, irresponsible risk taking, et cetera, et cetera. But if these large banks collapse, the little people, or to use the chairman of BP's characterization, the small people are the ones that get crushed when all of that stuff happens. The people that have the least are the ones that generally lose most of it. So one cannot sort of suggest that this is just another way of funneling more funds to the rich people, which I don't think you're quite saying in that way, but you seem to be dismissing the efficacy of keeping these banks solvent or keeping them in business so that they can do things that banks do.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, my response would be that the governments in this situation should think about nationalizing the banks and socializing the institutions of finance so that they actually serve the interests of exactly the small people, however you define them. I would call them ordinary people or citizens. So that finance is actually put to productive uses. I mean, in the 1930s, Roosevelt made it clear that when he was fighting the banks, that the banks would hate him. And Roosevelt was, you know, wanted to restore healthy capitalism. He was no socialist. But certainly the New Deal administration after the Second World War made it clear that during the sacrifices of the 1930s and the Second World War, you would no longer have a financial system that would destabilize things to such an extent that we had all of the convulsions of the 1930s, fascism and Nazism and so on, that you would actually make finance the servant of production and the producers. And the person that used that phrase was Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury. And initially an attempt was made after the Second World War to create a global financial system at Bretton Woods that would balance the interests of finance with the interests of other elements in society and produce a sustainable form of capitalism. And finance was, in fact, quite heavily regulated after the Second World War compared to the situation in the 1930s. So yes, you can't allow banks to simply fail and everybody's savings to be lost overnight. That's clearly not in no one's interests. What I think is the more important, more fundamental question is what kind of financial system we want and what interests will it work to support. And I could see a vastly more productive economy with much more leisure time for people, much better provisions for their retirements, much better education, that could be built into all of the ways in which we would think about regulating finance. Finance isn't something that should be separated from everything else and left to the so-called experts from the financial sector to regulate. The banks are much too important for them to be allowed to regulate themselves.
As to these other initiatives, I mean, there's proposals on the... We're going to get a general push towards fiscal consolidation, which is code for cutting spending and raising taxes. And everybody's going to be encouraged to go down that route, even though our governments and many members of the G20 are in very different phases of their recoveries. Some of them are not really recovering right now. There's a deep fear of a double dip in some European, perhaps in the Eurozone. Today, Harper and the Governor of the Bank of Canada are warning about a double dip. How do you coordinate a strategy when you have these diverse economies in different phases of recovery and pretend that it's coherent? I mean, is that possible or is that really just a pipe dream?
Well, it's possible under certain conditions because, as you correctly pointed out earlier in the discussion about the crisis, and I tried to say that there was a certain moment where, you know, that capitalism had a heart attack and they collectively responded and cooperated. That was a point where capitalism itself was fundamentally threatened. So cooperation is possible under certain conditions. The question is, what are the interests that will propel cooperation? And if these governments feel that they can move back to capitalism as normal as it was in the way that crisis erupted and emerged, and if they think that they can push the burden of adjustment on the backs of ordinary people in the way that I've been suggesting in the discussion, I think they are delusional. They may cooperate, that their cooperation will be unsustainable politically, and it will lead to enormous political conflicts, and with very unforeseeable consequences. I might add, incidentally, that the financial crisis itself has deflected attention from the fact that there are multiple crises, and that global leadership has abnegated its responsibility to respond to those crises. It, by comparison with the financial question, and the best example to give there is the abject failure of responding to the climate change problem and the problem of ecological and energy sustainability at the Copenhagen summit. We're on a completely unsustainable course in terms of our lifestyles and energy-intensive patterns of consumerism. There have to be big adjustments in these things. You don't really hear anything from the political leaders that show that they have any sense of how that relates to the financialized system and the problems that that's causing. So let's not underestimate the problems that are there. They're huge problems. They're enormous problems. But, of course, cooperation could occur. But if you get very different political interests coming into play, they're going to have to hammer out a different type of cooperation to the ones that we've seen so far.
In the end, what do you think will come out of this?
What I unfortunately fear will come out of this will be precisely what I was saying, that they will agree to move towards a stance which is generally based on what were called exit strategies earlier in an early phase of the rhetoric, which is that they will try to move back to situations of rough fiscal sustainability, manageable debt levels of the type, for example, that was sketched out in the Maastricht agreements. And to do that, of course, will require significant fiscal adjustment. And they'll try to ride the political consequences of that out. I think that that's probably what will happen.
In other words, the rejection or the resistance by populations in countries where you're imposing this kind of, essentially in Greece, they're imposing a 4 or 5 year recession to get their
In Greece, it's probably going to be a depression, I think. But they will assume that cases like Greece could be isolated politically, and that the problems can be contained internally. But we'll be going into a very new political situation. I think. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty, and I think if you look at the security apparatus that has surrounded the Toronto summit. The lockdown Toronto, where over $1 billion has been spent by the Harper government to host the summit, where you can't even catch a train into the centre of Toronto or a subway anymore because they've all been closed down weeks in advance. It shows either that the government wants to be a very welcoming host and it's saying to the visitors that you will be secure, or it's saying, really we perceive that what we're doing here is very threatening to many social interests. And we fear that there could be, even in peaceful Canada, a very significant reaction that could unnerve the leadership that's come together to try to come to some agreements.
It does look a little bit suspicious, doesn't it, that they have to meet behind these walls of security and everything's out of control and the heart of a city is completely disrupted for it. What you're doing that requires so much. Now, they will say, okay, the President of the United States is going to be here, the President of China, President Medvedev from Russia will be, all the leaders will be here, and you can't treat them like they're visitors. They have to be treated as assets that need to be protected. And we know the choreography of these things, that demonstrators will be out, there'll be, a cacophony of different interests that are being, and then there'll be violent people there as well. But who knows, there could be some assassins in that bunch too, that are coming to do real harm or trying to kill people. I mean, the security issue is ridiculous. Why not hold it in a castle someplace and or put it in the middle of Lake Ontario on a luxury liner and let them all meet there, and you could even have media there and broadcast it to the rest of the world. Well, there are ways to deal with it. You don't have to kill the heart of the city to do it.
Well, the G8 and the G20 are the public face of global power. They are the sovereign representatives, the heads of state, some democratically elected, others less democratically elected. But they claim to represent the populations of their country, and of course they need to be protected as heads of state. This is obviously imperative that you must provide a secure environment for these discussions to take place. But there's also a private side to this. The World Economic Forum, for example, less well-known but nevertheless important groups such as the Bilderberg meetings or the Trilateral Commission, these involve actually many of the same people, plus other interests in society, corporate leaders, in some cases security chiefs and so on. And they do meet in exactly the kinds of locations that you're talking about, luxury hotels on inaccessible islands. And there was a meeting here that was hosted by Conrad Black before he was incarcerated, of the Bilderberg group at his estate in King City, and they managed to get the Henry Kissingers of the world to and from Pearson Airport with a security corridor, and they kept everybody, including the journalists, out of the that space. I remember that was in the 90s. So it could be done. It's puzzling to me why they would want to do this in the centre of Toronto and antagonise many of the citizens in the largest city in the country, and to introduce new types of quote-unquote security devices, such as these sonic cannons. It seems unnecessary to me to go to this extreme for these types of meetings. Yes, they need to be secure, and yes, Canada has an obligation to provide that security, but there are many different ways to do all kinds of things.
Even if they'd moved it to the CNE, they could have probably, rather than shutting down the heart of the city, could have shut down an area around that in a very secure kind of way.
Well, exactly. I used to live near the X. It's constructed in such a way that it would be easily could be easily sealed off to everyone else.
There's a lot of and Harper seems to have totally destroyed whatever reputation he has for fiscal prudence and tight-fistedness. Although they don't really have, if you look at their spending, they're really not that tight-fisted. But by allowing, saying at first that the costs were going to be about $170 million. Now ballooned to $2 billion or $1 billion. Who knows what it's going to be when it's over?
Well, my understanding, again,
four of those cannons, by the way, I don't know if I told you this before, are being acquired by the city of Toronto. They could never afford to buy such a thing on their own. How many riots do the police in Toronto have to contend with? Not just one. They've got four of these cannons. They're not going to use them on the gay pride parade. They're not going to use them, during Caravana or anything mm-hmm. like that.
Well,
it's tools. You're just giving these guys tools paid for by Ottawa.
Who knows what they will use them for? But just on the very specific fiscal point that you made, my understanding, again based upon a very good Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives study, is that the Canadian expenditures in the first phase of the bailouts were actually proportionate to our GNP, larger than those in the United States. So I am not suggesting that stabilisation measures were not needed. They were needed. My argument is that there are always opportunity costs and there are always alternative ways of doing things. And as with the sonic cannons, as with fiscal prudence, we have alternatives.
I just want to draw you a little bit of a last question here, which was, you said if by pumping the money might have been better used if it was directed toward the money that we used to bail out banks or support banks. Although in Canada, they insist that they didn't really bail out the banks. There was this quantitative easing process where they bought guaranteed mortgages and they gave them cash to inject liquidity. But if it was used for healthcare or education or pensions or the social things that everybody can enjoy, mm-hmm. rather than going to the banks, in theory, that's great, but you still had to bail out those banks and keep them from collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't. It might have been nice to spend it all on that, but if the financial system collapsed and we had mm-hmm. better health care, people don't have jobs because their businesses mm-hmm. can't borrow because and on and on.
Yeah.
So there's a limit to how far you go. Now your proposal was to nationalize the banks. Who's nationalizing banks these days?
Well, you'd be surprised, because I think what effectively happened in Britain, for example...
there was one that was nationalised.
There was more than just one. Three of them were nationalised.
Well, okay, the North Rock, the Bank of Scotland, and what was the third one?
It was another of these former building societies that had become banks. I forget the name of it.
Okay.
So they don't call them nationalisations anymore. That's an unfashionable term, but it's basically we've got two things that have been going on in the situation. First of all, the socialization of the losses of these banks,
mm-hmm.
paid for by taxpayers' money, and of course those losses would indirectly affect some taxpayers who had savings in those banks. I agree with that, not all of them, but also in some cases taking control of the banks directly or indirectly. My view is that if that is clearly, this is something that would never happen under half a government in this country because of its political complexion and the interests it represents. But I'm talking about a different type of government. But you could have a situation in which, in exchange for the bailouts to stabilize the banks, you also require control, different systems of governance in the banks, so that what's euphemistically called stakeholders have more of a share, say, in the way in which banks lend, so that banks lend money for socially useful projects as well as things like speculating in commodity markets. And you require banks to pay levies that can be put on their future profits that would go into pools of resources that could be used for creating a better education system or a better healthcare system and so on. There's lots of different ways you could think about it. And there are many progressive economists that could advise much more, in a much more convincing way than I could about these things. But those people are never called upon to be experts. They're not drawn into the structures of governance. Right. And instead, we have relatively speaking, self-governance by the very interests that we are addressing that have been at the heart of the problem.
I wanted to ask you about, it looks like the bank tax is going to be back on the agenda again. At least that's what's emanating from Europe now. They want to push it. What do you make of that?
You mean the bank tax, not the Tobin tax?
The
tax on bank profits.
Yes. Well, it's not clear what they're taxing. Are they taxing capitalization? Are they taxing profits? Are they taxing salaries? It's not clear.
Yeah.
But Merkel is behind doing it. The EU, the head of the EU, is behind doing it. And they say they want it on the agenda, even though one thought it was taken care of when they met in Korea recently.
Right. Well, I must say I haven't followed that in detail, but the uniform taxation of banks is in principle a good thing, but of course the problem that it would create and does create theoretically is that what has been created over the last 30 years is a system of not simply self-regulation of financial institutions, but it's also been a kind of a competitive form of regulation. In other words, increasingly regulations shift relative to the competitive position of banks that operate in different jurisdictions. So whereas the European-wide harmonized banking tax system seems possible for reasons of jurisdiction, it might disadvantage foreign banks or banks in other locations if they were competing with banks domiciled in the European Union. So there is an issue of who is it an advantage or disadvantage in a competitive sense, which makes an agreement difficult on that front. The other type of taxation, which is a more radical proposal and has been proposed by things such as ATTAC, which is now a worldwide organization that originated in Europe, which is the association for roughly speaking for taxation on financial transactions. They have pushed for the so-called Tobin tax, which is a tax on financial transactions. In other words, every time there is a foreign exchange contract made or there is a shift of funds from location A to location B, a small tax is levied on that transaction, because it's been argued that rapid movements of finance into and out of jurisdictions and different kinds of assets is very destabilizing and it's difficult to regulate. And it was associated with the Asian crisis that occurred in the late 90s and various other recent crises, particularly in developing countries where money has moved into and out of their economies very quickly. And it's destabilized their financial systems and their economic activity. So that tax has been proposed and in fact was adopted, was endorsed by Gordon Brown before he lost the election recently in Britain, and in a modified form even by Sarkozy and other people in Europe, which would it's been argued that a very, very small level of taxation, perhaps 0.05% on each transaction would yield possibly up to $1 trillion that could be used for development programs or whatever could be decided upon. It could be used, for example, to help fund UN programs. But that seems to not be on the agenda. And it seems also that that our government has opposed this tax. But that's, in a sense, the most radical proposal that the G8 and G20 have sought to discuss in their recent meetings.
Yeah. And as to what will happen to this, it looks to be quite unpredictable right now. Other than the fact that, in the end, they may just reaffirm what they decided in Korea, and that is those who want to impose it, go ahead and impose it, but don't expect the rest of us to. And if we don't impose our banks, then somehow you're giving our banks a competitive
yeah.
advantage vis-a-vis the other guys, unless the transaction fee that you're talking about is applied.
Well, that would be a separate type of tax.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's as much as I need to discuss. I'm sure there's a hell of a lot more we
yeah.
can talk about.
Okay, great.
But I've got to boil this down to 2 minutes, and I have other voices that I'm going to include.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your thoughts on this. You're quite interesting. I'd be
yeah.
interested in reading.
Yeah, you can
paper.
You can have that.
Yeah.
It's just a backgrounder.
Thank you.
There you go. Very good. Let's have some lunch.
Right.